That was great, Charlie. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? By the great Harold Arlen. Okay, well, we're going to talk about the failure of liberalism. Now, some of you may know that I have some liberal tendencies. And we are a liberal church, fellowship, congregation, in a liberal denomination. So what am I talking about? And I'll tell you, the older I get, the more I am glad to be proven wrong. Let me repeat that. The older I get, the more I am glad to be proven wrong. Does this sound strange? Well, it's something I need to say to myself quite often. Because when I am open to your ideas, when I am willing to examine my beliefs, when I find out, for example, that Pluto is only a dwarf planet, not a real planet, I learn. Being willing to learn and tolerant of others' ideas is one of the great hallmarks of being liberal. Unitarian Universalists are liberal in their religion because we don't have a strict, changeless creed, because we are tolerant of differences among people, because we recognize that there are many paths to wisdom. Socrates said that the wise man knows that he is ignorant. The wise man knows that he is ignorant. Ignorant because he knows that he does not already know everything. And somewhere in our RE area, there was a saying on the wall, it may still be there, I hope it is, never engage in a dialogue, never have a conversation unless you are willing to be changed by that discussion. So these are wonderful values, and I remain proud to be a Unitarian Universalist. Now, I see where John Stites and Ed Prue are going to talk more about universalism next week, which is a good thing, because today I am going to talk more about the history of the Unitarian part of our tradition. Both traditions merged, what was it, about 1960, somebody? 61? Okay. And we had a lot in common, and we decided to join forces. Prior to that, these were two separate but similar religious tendencies. So I want to review some of the dark history, the failures, where things didn't quite meet the ideals that I've just described, perhaps, in our Unitarian history. And I'm going to concentrate on our liberal Unitarian ancestors, well-known persons like Thomas Jefferson, Theodore Parker, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, and some slightly lesser known Unitarians like Thomas Wentworth Higginson and Reverend Samuel Gilman. As a matter of fact, all of these figures that I've named, except for Jefferson, were in fact ministers. And all four of them were from Harvard Divinity School. So they had a lot in common, and they were very influential. We still have readings, and we refer to these figures yet today. I will finish with some challenges that we all face today, different challenges than were faced by these men in the 19th century. What is the term liberal really, anyway, and where does it come from? Well, it is the ideals that I described, but it does originate in the rise of science and an industry of the Industrial Revolution. At the same time, the ideas of the classics, the Greeks and the Romans, were rediscovered. This is what we refer to as the Renaissance and then the Enlightenment. Okay, so we're enlightened now. So that means we're open to other ideas. We're open to knowledge, not just from Christian dogma, but from all sources. And we are scientific in our approach to the world. We look for evidence. If someone makes an assertion, we say, well, that's fine. What is the evidence for that statement? Men like Benjamin Franklin and Joseph Priestley, who's considered one of the founding fathers of Unitarianism. He also invented air. I talked about that about a year ago. You remember inventing air? Well, he didn't really invent air. He discovered air, and what he actually invented was the carbonated soft drink. So when you drink a Diet Coke, or whatever you prefer, and it's fizz in it, and it's not a beer, which is natural fermentation, but it's added into it. That comes from Joseph Priestley, our great Unitarian forebear. So Franklin and Priestley were known across the world as men of science, inventors, but also men of public affairs, who believed that freedom of thought and the urge to build and profit would result in human progress. They opposed the dogma of church and state, the divine right of kings, and saw the industrialist as the leading man of both wealth and morality. Wedgwood, Erasmus Darwin, Channing were all great believers in the unity of science, industry, and profit. This was where our liberal tradition came from. So in this sense, Thomas Jefferson was a classic liberal. I was first inspired to explore the topic that we are dealing with today by David Bryan Davis's account of Jefferson and the issue of slavery. Davis recently published the third volume in his series on the problem of slavery. He is considered to be the historian who has most dealt with the idea of slavery. The idea throughout history, going back to ancient times, how it is expressed in the modern world, plantation slavery, and then, of course, the change in our ideas about slavery that eventually led to many people saying that slavery was a moral evil. This was not the case at one time. Slavery was never talked about as a moral evil in ancient times. It was just considered something that was normal, accepted, and generally a condition that you could earn your way out of, and then you wouldn't be a slave anymore. In The Limits of Idealism, in that chapter, Davis recounts how Jefferson struggled with the idea of slavery over the years. An early critic of slavery, Jefferson was never able to take a decisive stand to end the institution. A slave owner and a member of the planter aristocracy of Virginia, his wealth and station derived from his profits from plantation slavery. The leisure that he devoted to scientific study and public service was made possible by this great wealth. In his retirement, he was asked by a young enthusiastic reformer to put his reputation and prestige behind an effort to end slavery once and for all. And despite his distaste for the practice, he declined, saying that the time was not yet right for such a radical step. A few years ago, the UUA decided to change the name of our area from the Thomas Jefferson District to the Southeastern District. Jefferson's status as a slave owner until his death was given as the main objection. Despite Jefferson's great achievements as a founder of this country and a champion of the separation of church and state, he was no longer acceptable to the UUA. On July 4th, 1826, the great sage of Monticello died. The time to deal with the issue of slavery once and for all had not yet arrived, but it would crash down upon this country as the decades passed, with tragic results. Years of attempted compromise failed. It seemed to many by the 1850s that this hadn't worked out at all. Opinions on the issue had polarized, and the anti-slavery agitation of the North was met with increasing tyranny and rigidity in the South. Charleston, South Carolina, about 1850, passed the most stringent of all of the laws that were common then across the South against anti-slavery agitation. They would confiscate abolitionist literature at the post office. They drove local anti-slavery folks out of town. Freedom of speech was annulled. Only silence or pro-slavery talk was permitted by law. If you spoke out against slavery in Charleston, South Carolina during that time, very likely that your neighbor or someone overhearing it would turn you in to the authorities, and you would be met with very stern measures. Some anti-slavery folks were actually driven out of town and never returned. Now, in this atmosphere, we find the interesting case of the Charleston Unitarian Church. This is the church where Kathy and I were first members of Unitarian Universalism. It's a beautiful building right downtown Charleston. The cornerstone was laid in 1774, and it surprises a lot of people to learn that this church has been a Unitarian liberal religious church since the beginning and explicitly one of the first churches in the country to form the Unitarian Association in the 1830s. But they had actually been Unitarian for a number of years prior to that. So they're very liberal religious folks in Charleston, South Carolina. And they remain there today. They have never closed the building. They have never stopped being organized as a congregation. This church was pastored by Reverend Samuel Gilman of Harvard Divinity School, a New Englander, from 1819 to 1858. Although most of the church records from this period perished in the fires of Columbia, South Carolina, in 1865, it is said that Gilman never once mentioned the institution of slavery from his pulpit. He was undoubtedly aware of the Savannah Unitarian Church, where anti-slavery talk there led to the closure of that church in the 1850s. Now imagine our Unitarian minister, Pat Jobe, in this pulpit for 38 years and never once mentioning the issue of civil rights and racial discrimination. But that was Samuel Gilman. That was that church. Meanwhile, in Massachusetts, Gilman's fellow Harvard-educated Unitarians like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Theodore Parker, and the younger Thomas Wentworth Higginson were becoming flaming hot abolitionists. Under the influence of abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison, they became convinced that any gradual reform of slavery was impossible and that the evil of the institution could no longer be tolerated. Their approach went far beyond the more moderate efforts of free soil Republicans like Lincoln, whose strategy aimed simply at taking control of the federal government away from the South, which had dominated the federal government up until 1860. They demanded an immediate and unconditional end to the institution. Garrison, despite his radical views, remained convinced that nonviolent moral suasion was the best tactic against the evil practice of slavery. Garrison was so radical that at a public meeting on one occasion, he took a copy of the United States Constitution and burned it in front of the audience to demonstrate that the U.S. Constitution and the flag and the power of the federal government were all supportive of slavery. There was even talk in the North back in the 1820s of Massachusetts seceding from the Union over the issue in protest of fugitive slave laws and the federal support of the institution. But after many years of meetings, pamphlets, newspaper articles, the South seemed even more determined than ever to hold on to the institution. Then the issue of Kansas. This is very complicated political historical stuff, so I'm going to go very simple here. Read up on it, maybe you'll understand what I'm saying better. But Kansas became so important in the 1850s, it became a bloody battleground. Because as the compromise had been made in Congress, as each new territory became eligible to be a new state, the representation it would send to Congress became a crucial test. This would swing the control of the federal government toward the North or toward the South, depending on how the state voted, to be either a free soil state outlawing slavery or a slave state where slavery would be a legal institution. So, to make that happen, people flooded into Kansas from both sides, pro-slavery people and free soil people, abolitionists even, from the North. Violence and intimidation resulted. Essentially, acts of terrorism were quite common from both sides. Into this chaos came a stern figure from the North, a man of action rather than words. His name was John Brown. He was born in Connecticut to strict Calvinist parents, and he became convinced that he was called by God to end the evil of slavery once and for all, and that he was the man who was to take action, even if it involved the most extreme forms of violence. With his sons and other followers, he led a campaign of violence and intimidation across the state of Kansas, culminating in the murder of five pro-slavery men in 1855, who his followers hacked to death by broadswords. Brown himself did not strike a blow, but clearly was in command and approved of the result. Although his role in the massacre was concealed, he leapt to national prominence as a hero of abolition, the man of action that would take the extreme steps needed in the emergency. Brown then matured his greater plan, a plan that would have its final result at Harper's Ferry, Virginia in 1859. He proposed no less than a slave revolt against all the slave owners of the South, a recreation of the revolution in Haiti on a grander scale, arming the slaves who would then burn and slaughter the plantation owners and their families. But to do this, he needed weapons and supplies, which required financing. For this, he turned to the abolitionists of New England and the Northeast, finding mixed success until he encountered our famous Unitarian ancestors. Brown embarked upon a speaking tour, giving lectures from Syracuse to Boston, meeting privately with potential donors, and impressing all who met him with his stern, determined bearing. He gained audiences with many of the famous, such as the fiery, charismatic Theodore Parker, who was preaching to large crowds in Boston, the famous lecturer, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and a quieter figure, perhaps more famous today than in his time, Henry David Thoreau. All of these men and others gave Brown their endorsement, although it is said that they did not know the exact details of his role in the massacre in Kansas. What they did know, however, was that Brown needed arms and supplies and that he meant to settle the issue of slavery with revolt and bloodshed. Emerson met privately with Brown and reported that the man from Kansas had told him that he believed in two things, the Bible and the Declaration of Independence, and that it was better that a whole generation of men, women, and children should pass away by a violent death than that a word of either should be violated in this country. According to Brown's biographer, Stephen Oates, Emerson assumed that Brown was merely speaking metaphorically. But Oates said Emerson should have known better. He should have known that Brown was not a man of metaphor, but a man of action. Another Harvard-educated Unitarian minister was the enthusiastic supporter of Brown, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, later become colonel of the 1st South Carolina Colored Troops. Colored ex-slaves were organized into military organizations, several of them, and Wentworth Higginson was one of the colonels. Before this, though, he became one of the secret six who directly funded Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. Theodore Parker, perhaps our most famous Unitarian minister, was another member of the secret six. After the war, Higginson was one of those who gave Brown credit for doing what needed to be done. Was Higginson right? Were the 900,000 deaths caused by the Civil War really necessary? Now, that's a big question. Historians like Alan Nevins, and he is in the minority among historians, but he's argued that the war could have been avoided if a reasonable political compromise could have been reached. It's impossible to say for sure whether that was possible, but it is clear that after Brown's raid, the paranoia of the South reached such a level that talk was no longer effective. Today, Unitarian Universalists talk of peace and compromise. We say that love and listening to all points of view are always the right choice, always effective. But in our past is a stark and dark history, a choice made by some of our most influential leaders, men much admired today. And that choice was to embrace violence, to support and encourage the revolt of John Brown. While Brown's attempt at a slave revolt failed, with his small band surrounded and overwhelmed by military forces led by U.S. Colonel Robert E. Lee, his actions so polarized the contending sides that reason, tolerance, and understanding, the very essence of our liberal faith, were abandoned. Today we face new challenges. Neil Jones, in one of the last sermons in his ministry of the Columbia congregation, talked about the moral issue of income inequality. He was kind enough to send me a copy of his sermon, and I'm referring to it today in my remarks. So I give him credit for his careful research of this topic that I cite here. One more person that I forgot to credit at the beginning that I should credit is my editor, my inspiration, the person who's the best editor and the most inspiring person that I know, and that's Kathy Jaggers. Thank you, Kathy. I would never come before you with anything that I've written until Kathy has read it. So every 4 years, the Unitarian Universalist Association selects an issue for study and discussion. We're familiar with the study and discussion about GLBT issues. We became a welcoming congregation. We're familiar with earlier discussions on civil rights. There's been others, I'm sure. And we hope that our discussions along these different topics will lead to some social action when change is required. Income inequality now is the newest topic, and guidance for study in our congregations can be found on the UUA website, just as we've studied other things. As I mentioned, the gap between the very rich and the rest of us continues to grow. Jones mentions that a fifth of all children in the United States live in poverty, the highest percentage of any developed nation except Romania. Anybody here today from Romania? Yeah, we do. George Capali back there. Yeah. Romania is a wonderful place, but they do struggle with poverty, right, George? Yeah. But we're just above Romania. Isn't that amazing? But above the poverty line, the news is just as bad. The real wealth of the great majority continues to decline, while the 400 wealthiest Americans have more wealth than 150 million of their fellow citizens. How can this be? What has happened? Well, what's happened, says Neil Jones, is that there has been a massive redistribution of wealth upward to the very rich. Corporate taxes are now at a 40-year low. Corporations such as GE, Boeing, and Verizon paid, quote, no federal taxes between 2008 and 2011. With tax rates lowered, austerity is required. Government programs such as education, road maintenance, environment, they must be cut. The job producers in the corporate offices paid large sums to influence government decisions, and then in turn export manufacturing jobs when the cost of labor is less overseas. The jobs that are produced now have lower pay and fewer benefits, forcing most households to have two working parents and often more than just one job. In my work as a private practice social worker, I often see clients who are exhausted, suffering depression, anxiety, whose marriages are in trouble, who get no joy out of life. And when I ask them just a few basic questions, oftentimes they don't know how many hours a week they work. I ask them to add it up. And when they add it up, there's a figure like 65, 70. And they're stunned. And I ask them, well, how can anybody do anything except for work? How can you pay attention to your wife and children? How can you do anything if you're working that many hours every week? And all they can say is they just do that just to survive, just to get by. So now we Unitarian Universalists are being encouraged to talk about this situation. Now we could ignore it altogether, as Samuel Gilman ignored slavery for 38 years. But as religious liberals, we feel compelled to work on these issues. Now, so what obstacles do we confront if we have an honest discussion? Some of you may already have been challenged by this topic today. You know, is it even appropriate to talk about this from the pulpit? If you're worried about tax status, I will quote from the fact sheet on churches and politics published by Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, which states, houses of worship may discuss policy issues, but they may not issue statements endorsing or opposing candidates. So I will not talk about any of our current presidential candidates right here today, but I will encourage all of you to become informed and support that candidate who does the best job speaking to this important issue. Now, can we as liberals deal with this issue effectively? Our traditions of science and industry are based in a faith that freedom of thought and free effort will lead to human progress, that individual effort should be rewarded with profit and wealth. That's our tradition. Many of our most important Unitarian ancestors were indeed highly educated, wealthy men and women, and we retain a high respect for education today. Can the current international corporate economy be made more progressive? Can income inequality be addressed by reform of this system? Or do we need another paradigm, an economy based on democracy and not corporate ownership? Do our cultural values continue to favor the Harvard-educated, well-placed, refined person? Or are we ready to shift to embrace a broader democracy, a more diverse congregation with support for a congruent shift to a more democratic economy? Will this fellowship look for those who can make a substantial pledge as new members? Or we also welcome all to our membership, no matter what their ability to pledge, as long as they support our seven principles. Neil Jones says that one of the failings of religious liberals is that when we talk about social, political, and economic issues, we tend to use the secular language of science, statistics, and policy analysis, and in so doing, cede the moral ground to religious and political conservatives. There is, in fact, an important moral dimension to this problem of income inequality, to the unspoken fact of class difference in this country. We will see if our vision of democracy and social justice emboldens us to undertake this effort. What we need is a greater vision, a vision of a land that belongs to all of us. Can we imagine this? What can we imagine? Can we see no possessions? No need for greed or hunger? All the people sharing all the world? If we only live in the safe world we have today, what do we achieve? Do we dare to risk more?